Welcome to Season 10 of American Political History, the North American Contest, Plains of Abraham. With victory across most of North America in 1758, the English forces would rest over the winter and begin their campaign against Quebec in 1759. But even on the verge of expelling the French from Canada, the colonies would have to be prodded to fully support this campaign. In Massachusetts, they had already accumulated a quarter of a million pounds sterling in war debts, and their annual tax revenue rarely exceeded 100,000 pounds sterling. With pressure from Whitehall, it would finally agree that they could raise a force of 5,000 militia for the campaign of 1759. Connecticut had the same problems, and eventually, after some cajoling, would provide 4,000 militia. As Connecticut went, so went New Jersey, New York, New Hampshire, and even Rhode Island. And the southern and middle colonies did little to aid this war effort. And Georgia, being so sparsely populated, actually required the garrison of British redcoats for its defenses. South Carolina said it was supporting Georgia, and North Carolina did nothing for any war effort. Maryland also did nothing, but that was because it was locked in a bitter political dispute between the proprietary family and the rest of the people living in Maryland. Virginia had raised 1,000 militia under the command of Colonel William Byrd, but they were using this militia to hold the Forks region after the destruction of Fort Duquesne. Pennsylvania was willing to use its militia to defend the Forbes Road, all the way to the fortified trading post being set up at Pittsburgh, which was rapidly becoming the center of native trade in the Ohio Valley. After months of prodding, the colonies would eventually raise troops approximating the same levels as they had in 1758. A total of 17,000 militia were being prepared for the invasion of Canada. Brigadier General John Perdue would lead the expedition to attack Fort Niagara. This expedition would receive enthusiastic support from the Iroquois. The Iroquois feared that the Shawnee and Delaware were attempting to create their own independent confederacy of native nations, which would directly threaten the Iroquois League, but without French support, the Iroquois knew that the Treaty of Easton had solidified in the eyes of the English their dominant role over the other nations of the Ohio Valley. With the exception of a few scouts that had joined Bradstreet's expedition, the Iroquois had not actually involved themselves in this war, that is, until the campaign of 1759. Perdue's expedition would arrive outside Fort Niagara in July 1579. Because the Seneca had decided to switch sides in the war, the French garrison there had received no intelligence on the English expedition's movements. Their first indication was when the Seneca, who were friendly in their fort, suddenly decided without explanation to leave. The next day, the English expedition would appear and begin building siege lines around the fort. A few days later, on the 14th, the English cannons were in position and began the bombardment of the fort. Even the death of General Perdue, who accidentally stepped in front of a live cannon shot, did nothing to slow the momentum of the English siege. On the 23rd, a French army of 1,600 appeared above Niagara River. Unlike prior battles, the Iroquois had given intelligence to the English, who had already prepared for the incoming French army relief. At an advantageous river crossing, which they had had time to defensively reinforce, the French were forced to attack the English. When the French realized the strength of the English position, they retreated and were flanked and routed by the Iroquois. Within hours of the defeat of the relief army, the French commander at Fort Niagara surrendered without honors to the English. The French feared that they would be left to the whims of the English's native allies as revenge for Fort William Henry. The only thing that saved them was that the Iroquois were perfectly happy to plunder the fort, leaving the hassle of prisoners of war for the English to deal with. With the loss of Fort Niagara, the French had been completely pushed out of the Ohio Valley, and their western frontier above the Great Lakes had been rolled back to Montreal. The French would begin destroying their smaller frontier forts and consolidating their forces around Montreal and Quebec. The difficulty for General Amherst was interpreting whether this was a retreat back to Montreal because of weakness or a feint to get him to extend his army too deep into French territory. He would order his forces in the Ohio Valley to dig in and begin construction of forts to consolidate their victory, awaiting news on the status of the expedition set to attack Quebec. On June 28th, General Wolfe's expedition would arrive south of Quebec. The French had had time to develop a multi-ring defensive network stretching for miles in and around Quebec. The English expedition would begin testing the strength of the differing French fortifications. As it became clear of the strength of the French's defensive position, this would eliminate any notion of a frontal attack. The English would begin devastating anything left unprotected on the countryside near and around Quebec's fortifications. General Montcalm had understood that if Quebec fell, the French would be expelled from Canada, and the war in North America would be permanently settled. At the end of August, General Wolfe, his physical health deteriorating, had begun concocting a plan in which the English expedition would either have a glorious victory or an ignominious defeat, in which he would not live long enough to see anyways. General Wolfe would consult Robert Stobo, an English officer who had been held as a prisoner of war in Quebec until recently. He had escaped with detailed sketches of Quebec's defenses. General Wolfe kept the details of this plan even from his brigadier generals, ordering troop movements with no explanation. On the night of September 11th, he would order a couple thousand soldiers into boats without any further orders. At 2 a.m., the first wave of boats landed close to the north shores of Quebec. In the moonlight, which was limited, gave the French sentries little ability to make out the silent passing of English columns. The men would scramble up a 170-foot-tall bluff with fixed bayonets and charge the French encampment. The surprise attack worked flawlessly. By dawn, General Wolfe was able to land and assemble his army half a mile from Quebec's walls. There, on the plains of Abraham, he would assemble his army in a line 1,000 feet across, awaiting his counterparts to take up his challenge, an invitation for one glorious winner-take-all battle. General Montcalm had been up all night supervising the defenses against a feint by Admiral Sanders, so preoccupied he had already ignored the first message about the landing party near Quebec. When General Montcalm saw the large English army forming on the plains of Abraham outside of Quebec, he was said to be thunderstruck, speechless for a couple of minutes. General Montcalm knew that his forces in Quebec were already out of provisions, and he convinced himself that the only tactical option was to go out there and defeat the English army. Little did he know that General Wolfe had not even brought tools or provisions for a siege with his army. Without any communication, both generals had decided independently that the only strategic action was to fight each other on the plains of Abraham. At 10 o'clock, General Montcalm ordered his troops to march into the battlefield. Almost immediately, French militia would break ranks and retreat. All that would remain on the battlefield were the veteran French soldiers. The redcoats stood silently, perfectly still, machines crafted by warfare. Almost every man in the English army had seen combat for years, from Braddock's failed attack to the sieging of French forts in the wilderness. The French would open the combat with a volley of cannon fire. Most of the English would charge forward with bayonets fixed, except for the Scottish soldiers of the 78th, who, slinging their muskets on their back, unsheathed their giant claymore swords before running towards the enemy. General Montcalm positioned his best soldiers on the flanks, who turned at the sight of the English advance and created a two-sided kill zone. And in the chaos, General Wolfe would receive what he wished for, the most glorious death on the battlefield. Although the initial volley was devastating, he could not produce the firepower needed to stop the advancing English army. The English would crash into the French lines like a tsunami, and the rest of the battle would be spent in mosh mud pits, hand-to-hand combat with bayonets. The French discipline would eventually break, and the lines would begin retreating, as the English would attempt to kill every retreating person they could. Brigadier Townsend, the only surviving chief of staff of the English, would begin to rally and reform his lines when another French army was spotted on their rear. As the English reformed their battle lines for a second incoming French army, it suddenly retreated, taken aback by the spectacle and a complete loss of the other French army defending Canada. On September 13th, siege lines would be dug around Quebec. On the 17th, English cannons were in position to bombard the city, when the French commander would raise the white flag of truce and send out emissaries to discuss terms of capitulation and surrender. Brigadier Townsend would initially offer surprisingly generous terms of surrender to the French. With that, the French militia would begin to surrender to the English before the commanding officer had even accepted those terms. The French regulars were to sail back to France on parole. The French militia would give up their weapons and swear an oath of fealty to the British crown and return to their family and farmsteads. All civilians would be required to take the oath of fidelity to the King of England, as all British subjects are required to do. And the civilian population of Quebec were to become British subjects if they chose to stay. Brigadier Townsend had no intention or capability of occupying Quebec. Instead, he offered the most generous terms of capitulation to the population of Quebec. He was desperately in need of their volunteer cooperation, because he knew he would soon have to fend off another French army. And on September 18, 1759, Quebec would be surrendered to the English. Brigadier Townsend inherited the same mess as General Montcalm had in Quebec, a force of 7,000 soldiers and 4,000 civilians, sick and starving. So, Brigadier Townsend opted to return to England on October 18th when Admiral Sanders' fleet was sailing out of the St. Lawrence before it froze over. Brigadier James Murray, who apparently drew the short straw, would become the commandant of the Quebec garrison and its city's population. Thank you for listening to this episode of American Political History. If you want to support the show, please subscribe and leave a 5-star rating. And share this show with someone you think would enjoy listening. Thank you again, and until next time.